Are you a knock?
I'm sorry?
Are you a knock?
A knock? Sorry, I don't know what that is.
A knock.
A knock. Am I speaking fucking Japanese?
Yeah, listen to him.
I'm gonna sound it out for you. Are you or are you not a knock? A fucking knock. Like Johnny Depp in 21 Jump Street.
I see. Okay, a narc.
A knock, yes.
Yes, no.
What was I saying?
I was missing the R when you were saying, I heard knock, but apparently
He said
knock. I said fucking knock.
Another Surviving Grady podcast. Honestly, we haven't done a podcast in like 2 years. It's two, possibly 3 years. I don't know. The day job has got me going all over the country, and Denton's off writing novels and attending ritzy banquets and whatnot and all that. But today marks as good an occasion to get back into the podcasting game as any. My guest is Weymouth native, Red Sox fan, Hollywood actor type, Nate Cordry. You've seen him on The Daily Show on Comedy Central, the sitcom Mom on CBS, the NBC drama Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, movies like The Heat, which was filmed here in Boston, most recently the Tom Hanks film The Circle, plus a shit ton of theater commercials, soap operas, his own podcast called Reading Aloud. You're like a Renaissance man, Nate, pretty much.
I just try to keep busy, because if I'm not busy, I want to shoot myself. So you learn that as you age. You know, when you're in your 20s and trying to pursue a creative life, like, nothing really matters, and all you're thinking about is, like, trying to get a job and trying to get an agent and all that bullshit. But as you get older, like, priorities shift. And so when I'm not working on something, I just get angry and start punching walls. So I don't want to do that anymore.
Then you'll fit in very well right here, because punching walls is pretty much what I'm all about. But I do thank you and for well, I'll just say what it is. I thank you for slumming with me today. So this will be good. I do love The Heat, by the way. I love that fucking movie. And I will say this: your Boston accent in that movie was actually better than Joey McIntyre's, and he is technically more Boston proper than you, if I believe, because you're Weymouth. But I think he's the city. Is he Dorchester?
He is Jamaica Plain.
Jamaica
so
Plain.
He is city. But I appreciate that compliment. That was a table full of Bostonians. You had Jamie Dembo and Jessica Chaffin playing the sisters, who are both from Massachusetts. And Joe, of course, is from JP. And Bill Burr is from Canton. So it was like a table full of Massachusetts jerk-offs. And it was very clever casting on Paul Feig and Allison Jones's part. Allison Jones is the casting director for basically every comedy that you love. They specifically cast New England people, Boston people, to be around that table. The main scene that we're all in was around that, like, dinner table when Melissa McCarthy comes home. And it took like 10 or 11 hours to shoot, but most of it is improvised. They would just sort of feed us lines and we would go off on our own. He just had enormous trust that these bozos from New England could improvise and insult Sandra Bullock for 7 hours, which was just great fun. So I appreciate the praise. It's a great movie. It turned out really well, and I think it's it might be my favorite movie that I've been in. I think there are many of them, but it's very, very good.
I think that should be the prototype for all Boston accents on film. I think Scorsese should have actually talked to you before The Departed, because that's the worst. I maintain
absolute shit show.
The worst. Yeah. It was like they would do. Is this a Kennedy's miniseries? I don't know who the fuck was instructing them on that, but
I have two others that are worse, and I'm not sure if your listeners have even seen these movies. But as far as Boston accents go, like, these movies are unwatchable because of it. 13 Days, which actually is a pretty, like, compelling film about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Kevin Costner is unwatchable. I mean, it is like, it's a fucking disaster. And I'm like sitting in the theater, like, rocking back and forth, like, make it stop. And then Diane Lane in The Perfect Storm, which also is a fucking garbage movie. But her accent and everyone else's accent, besides Mark Wahlberg, who's just being he's just playing himself, basically.
Basically.
That movie was also infuriating accent-wise. So there's been a bunch of shitty accents, you know?
I still say that one of the best ever, I love yours, but I still say one of the best ever, surprisingly, was Jimmy Fallon in Fever Pitch. He seemed more realistic to me, even though he's New York. He seemed more realistic to me as a Boston guy than half the people who, you know, these quote-unquote hardcore actors who do this
yes.
stuff.
But... Yeah, for some reason, he just got it. Like, he gets that accent and gets that character and that type of behavior. He's great.
Oh, well, like I said, thank you for slumming with me here today and talking Red Sox. But on that topic, I guess my first question is, what's it like watching Red Sox games at 4 p.m. every day?
It's very strange. It's one of the great things about moving to the West Coast is that you get all your sports watching done early. Football is the best because it starts at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So the morning games, you have breakfast and like have coffee and eggs and bacon while you watch the first round of games. And it's great. It's the best. And you don't have to stay up until midnight watching the Sunday night game. It's over by 8. Or if you don't want to watch that game, you're done with games, the morning and afternoon games, like by 5, which is just the best. Or usually by 4. But baseball, it is nice to just like be done with it before, so you can like have an evening. If you want to go out to dinner, or you want to like, and there's a big game, you don't have to be tied up until 10 o'clock, but it is fun when the Red Sox come west and play Seattle or Oakland, and I can actually watch at 7 o'clock and like have a beer and watch the Sox. But I enjoy getting it sort of done, you know, before late. Like, extra innings are never a problem for me.
See, that's awesome.
Which is a nice little bonus.
That is awesome. You can actually have a life. That's a great...
Exactly.
But you're most people in this area, you're born here. You're from Weymouth. I grew up in West Roxbury. So you're born here. You're kind of a Red Sox fan from birth. And in my house, we didn't watch football or basketball or hockey. My dad was just baseball, and that's how it went. Was that pretty much how it was in your house? Did the die pretty much cast from birth that you're a Red Sox fan?
Yeah, pretty much. And my dad is from Maryland, and my mom was born in Vermont and was raised in Maine. And they met in the middle in Boston. So my dad grew up sort of an Orioles fan, but as soon as he moved to Boston, everything changed. And I think it was 67, the Impossible Dream year, that really sort of like made it, like it went into his bloodstream because of that season, because that season was so spectacular. But yeah, I mean, I would watch the Celtics on Saturday and Sundays on NBC, but I couldn't, like, you couldn't go to a game in the 80s because they were too good.
Right.
So, and I was into the Bruins for a couple years, and I like the Bruins now, but for some reason it was always baseball. And the Patriots are so terrible. I would watch their game, but I wouldn't watch the NFL. Now I watch the NFL because I like fantasy football, but I was only a Patriots fan. But yeah, it was sort of Red Sox through and through. I have to pause this conversation very briefly because DirecTV is here to fix my fucking dish. Can you give me 2 minutes?
Absolutely.
Hold on 1 second. I'm going to put you on pause. Oh, this is so bizarre. Hold on. Hey, man. So sorry about that. My DirecTV is like getting fixed. It's going to be great. Now I can continue to talk about the Red Sox. I apologize for that delay.
We got to have you watching the games, man. We can't have any issues there.
Exactly. It's crazy. He was on, like, they fucking, he was supposed to show up here at noon, and he showed up here exactly at noon. I was sure he'd be 4 hours late. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
That's insane.
Yes.
All right. Well,
sorry, go ahead.
Tell me about the. All right. So you grew up in Weymouth. Can you tell me about the first time you went to Fenway Park? What you remember the most vividly? Anything? Any memories from that magical day?
Yeah, I think it was a mixture of awe and fear. You know, like I was a little boy. I was 9 or 10, and we never got tickets. Like, we never went because it was too expensive and we just didn't have like the money to drive into Boston and park and go to the game. And it was like, we just never got tickets. And my dad got a pair of tickets from work. He worked at Massport at Logan Airport for 30 years. And some guy had an extra 4 tickets. So I think the whole family maybe went, maybe it was 5 of us. I'm not sure. I don't remember. But what I do remember is this. I remember the first time walking up the ramp from the darkness of the underground. And it was on the first base side, And walking up from the sort of the darkness where there's no sunlight to an open field, the green, that I'd never seen that color green before. It was like in The Wizard of Oz, like all of a sudden it was like Technicolor. And it looked small. It was amazing how enormous it looks on television. Then you get there in person and the wall really is just like right there.
Yeah.
And then it was smell. For a long time, I had like post-traumatic stress. Every time I smelled, because back then you could like smoke cigars and shit like in the park, which is just madness.
And that was just the players.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I was just Yastrzemski. Yeah. There was like the smell of dirt and fresh cut grass and urine and cigar smoke. Like, that's what Fenway smelled like to me. And the fear part was, one, was going to the men's room, because back then it was the troughs, which are just fucking terrifying for a little boy, for a nine-year-old boy to step up there and try to – I mean, I think there's still urine stuck inside of me that was, like, terrified to get out. I'm taking on my Johnson in front of these guys. Are you fucking kidding? I'm like, my head is coming up to just a bunch of flaccid dicks, like, the entire – I mean, it was terrible. And I remember my dad, like, go, go. And I was like, Dad, I don't. I'm scared. He's like, just fucking piss. Just, come on. I got to get another beer. And then being around grown men who I didn't know that they were drunk, but being around grown-ups who yelled and swore, like, that was not part of my family dynamic. We are, like, New England Protestants. We don't yell. We don't share our feelings. Like, to be around a bunch of guys in their – I mean, they looked really old to me, but they're probably in their 20s and 30s. But they were just, like, fucking screaming and saying, fuck you, Nick Asaski, or whoever the fuck they were screaming at. And it was – I was like, whoa, am I going to get hurt? And I remember looking up at my dad, because, like, the guys behind us were, you know, seven beers in and yelling and screaming. And he didn't – and they were like, sorry, kid. You know, sorry. This is the stuff that your father says when you're not around. And my dad kind of laughed and chuckled. And they were like charming, like, New England bozos. But I remember being afraid because I was like, seems like someone's going to get in a – like, these guys are mad. Like, am I in trouble? So it was a real mix. That's a long answer to your question, but Fenway Park is a complicated place.
No, it is. It's kind of, and I feel the same way. It's funny you mentioned, you know, that shit never gets old for me. Like, I still, I'm an old man now, but going there and walking up that ramp, and it's just, you know, it never really. I mean, it's like, it is like another fucking world. You go up there, and it's like you're teleported somewhere where, you know, all this other bullshit doesn't seem to matter. I mean, of course, yeah, it's dodging. Yes. It's still dodging urine and projectiles thrown by drunks, but still, it's a. But it's just, you know, it's always kind of had that sort of otherworldly quality to it as far as I'm concerned. What about the last time you were there? Now, you're a season ticket holder, but, I mean, that can't possibly be convenient for you.
Yeah, when they reached out to me, because I'd been on the waiting list for like 10 years, and they reached out to me three seasons ago after we won in 2013, and they said
– Somebody died.
Someone died, and they said, your name came up. Are you interested in being a season ticket holder? And I said, well, I live 2,500 miles away, but yes, I am, which was a real stupid move because in 2014 and 2015, they finished in last place. So I felt like I had something to do with that, so I canceled them. So I am no longer a season ticket holder. It was also like a money suck. Like, I was on a show during those 2 years, and I'm an unmarried guy who doesn't have like debt, so I was like, oh, I'll throw a bunch of money at this dream.
Exactly.
But, you know, sold 85% of them online to strangers. I have two nephews and my sister back in Boston, and my mom is there part of the summer, and my dad is there in the summer, so I gave most of my tickets to them, and like any, you know, friends and family who needed tickets, I always gave them to them. But yeah, I just, to answer your question about the last time, I went there with my girlfriend 2 weeks ago. I was home for a weekend, and she had a she's an actor, and she had a film in a in the Boston Independent Film Festival, and it was playing at the Somerville Theater, which was great, okay. Or Coolidge Corner, and I took her to the Cubs Saturday Cubs game.
Oh, nice.
And the Red Sox lost, unfortunately, but it was a great game. But you know, it's not what it used to be. 99% for the better.
Right.
Because you can, like, I remember being there as a kid when you, like, you got in with your ticket, but you couldn't go to other sections of the park.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you weren't allowed, if you got a bleacher ticket, you couldn't go anywhere else. And if you were sitting in the grandstands, they wouldn't allow you, like, down into the low seats or whatever. Like, you couldn't move around. It was like jail. And so now it's open, and there's space, and you can get any kind of food, and it's family friendly, and they're really pushing the, like, isn't this charming? And holding on to everything that's great about it being a park that's 100 years old. But I think just my nostalgia, I miss the grit and the grime a little bit. I miss, you know,
you
miss the danger.
You miss the trough. You can come right out and say it. You miss the
exactly.
Trough.
So I had a trough installed in my own house, so it makes me feel better. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's polished. It's a little bit like Disney World.
Yeah.
It's really, really clean and really, really shiny. But you know what? It's the design of the place inside is gorgeous, and the men and women who've, like, had to, like, update everything while keeping it looking like it's over 100 years old, that's a really hard job.
Right.
So I applaud all of their efforts. It's a great place to go. I mean, there isn't a better place on earth.
No. The only thing I've ever said, and I've said this many times before on the site, is that it's just there is a certain charm to being in the same grandstand seats that perhaps someone who voted for Grover Cleveland back in the day might have used as well. But
yes,
man, I'm like a, if you can imagine a more out of shape Louis C.K. That's basically what I look like. And
oh my God, you're a great big fat.
I'm about 6'2" and about 240 pounds, and those the grandstand seats. I mean, I literally it will be in situations where I'll say, I just won't go if it's a grandstand seat.
No.
I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, it's too highfalutin for that. But it sometimes it's painful. I can just say from my experience.
Yeah, no, please. No. Yeah, that's 3 miserable hours. And depending on where you're sitting, you may not be facing the fucking field. Some of those seats up the left field, the right field line are aimed towards the outfield.
Right.
So the entire game, you're craning your neck to the left or the right. It's like, I'll just watch at home.
Yeah, exactly. I like Jerry's insights anyways. But do you – now, do you get to any ball games out? Now, you're in a complete, you come from Boston, where we have this old-fashioned ballpark, and baseball is religion. And you live in, I'm assuming, L.A., Hollywood. That's that kind of area out that way. Do you get to games out there? I mean, is the other ballparks stack up as well? I mean, I'm assuming the passion isn't quite the same, or maybe it is.
Yeah, the passion certainly is not the same. But I go to Dodger games all the time. Dodger Stadium is great. It was built in the 50s, and it's been updated a bunch, but it's the weather is always beautiful. I don't go to day games in the summer because it gets too hot, but night games are just the best. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, 68 degrees, and out in center field there's this beautiful mountain range with palm trees, and that color, deep Dodger blue, is everywhere, and it's a team, it's a franchise with enormous history. And when I was living in New York, I lived in Brooklyn, and I was, like, kind of fascinated with the Brooklyn Dodgers and where Ebbets Field was, which is now low-income housing in, like, a really fucking shitty area of Brooklyn. But I was kind of fascinated by the Dodgers and their story and Jackie Robinson and why they moved. And they have enormous tradition. They've been around for a long time. So the fans there are really passionate. But, you know, if I'm generalizing – because of traffic, because there's no public transit to get there, it's they show up late and they leave early. There are passionate Dodger fans, of course, and they're everywhere. But it's not like East Coast. East Coast baseball is just different. people just, it's in their blood, and I think it's because of the winters.
Exactly.
I think because you suffer through those winters, you appreciate spring much more.
Yeah.
Here, you don't suffer. Here, every day is easy. So you don't really earn it. But Dodger Stadium is fucking great. Anaheim is ugh, yuck, yuck, yuck. It's so fucking gross. It's just, though, it's no thank you.
It looks a little – the only place I've ever been outside of Fenway is Camden Yards, which is phenomenal if you've never been there. That's a beautiful place. But I've always wanted to get down. I wanted to get to Petco. I was in San Diego on business a couple of years ago, but I never had a chance to go. But there are some parks that are equally as impressive as Fenway, but I've always just been kind of curious as to how fandom is.
Hold on 1 second.
Sure.
Sorry.
Is the wall falling down over there?
The cable is getting old.
Okay.
So it's like cracking and stuff. So I'll just go ahead and replace that.
Great.
And also I'll change out the MLB real quick.
Cool.
Do you know, I see that it's the cable is going in at the bottom.
Yes.
Does it go through that door?
Yes.
That door
I can unlock it for you now.
Is it okay if you can unlock it for
Of course. Of course, man. Right. Thanks. We're making podcast history here. You get to hear me talk to a dude from DirecTV. Who, like, you think I'm just like fancy Hollywood actor? Nah, man, I'm just a regular person.
I say Hollywood
whose cable
people.
Wires, Hollywood people. Yeah,
just
I'm a
like
Hollywood
us.
Animal. Exactly. I'm so sorry to delay this another 10 seconds, but I have to go unlock a door.
Do what you got
to
do.
Okay, I'll be back in like 2 minutes. All so right. Sorry, dude. I'm back. Sorry about that.
God, hey, man, you got to have your DirecTV. We can't fuck with that.
No, we can't. We can't. We mustn't. We mustn't.
You must.
What are we talking
this
about?
There's residuals to be had. Don't you get paid
Goddamn
every time
right.
someone watches something like that?
Goddamn right I do.
How does that shit work? Like, you were on that show, Mom. And how does that work? Do you get a check every once in a while? I mean, when that gets syndicated, obviously the dream is for that shit to get syndicated and you continue to get paid often, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yeah, it differs depending on what it is. Uh-huh. If it's a network show, as opposed to a cable show, as opposed to a movie being like a pay-per-view kind of movie, like or downloads on iTunes.
Uh-huh.
A network television show, you get paid basically the first time it airs, you get a little chunk of money. And then every time after that, it gets less and less. So it sort of like goes down. As it airs more. I mean, every time it airs, you get a little something.
Okay.
But it's not like thousands of dollars.
Oh.
Like, the 10th time an episode of Mom airs, I'll probably make, I don't know, a couple, maybe like $300.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, it's not big money, but I call it free money, which is the fucking greatest. It's the same thing with commercials. You get paid for the day's work, and then once it starts airing, you get paid X amount of dollars. And the first 10 times, that's when you get paid the most. And then if it continues to air, the money gets sort of less and less.
But I look at it this way, man. Your job when you were on that show, your job was basically someone saying, there's Anna Faris. You get to go hang out with her, and here's some money for doing that. That's pretty fucking awesome.
No, I am most certainly in the 1%. I am unbelievably lucky to have the opportunities that I've been given. It's bananas. I still shake my head when I'm in certain situations with certain people, and I just think, how the fuck did the Weymouth Wildcat make it here? But just luck.
Which is fucking luck. Awesome. But I mean, so I see now, obviously your whole family, they see like the trailer for The Circle, the new Tom Hanks movie, or it's really an Emma Watson movie, but you're front and center on that. At least the trailer I saw, the first thing we see is you talking to Emma Watson. And I hope, please tell me she smells like cinnamon and fresh-cut grass and strawberries and all that, because she just seems to walk on air as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, she smells like all the things that you want her to smell like. And couldn't be kinder and sweeter. And that scene in the movie, which is basically like, I'm in a few other scenes, but very, very minor stuff, but that scene is basically my contribution to the movie. But it was rewritten that morning by the writer and director, James Ponsoldt. So I got there having worked on the 10 pages that I had, and I got there and it was like the 10 pages were completely different. And he's like, all right, so we're doing this in an hour and you have to memorize these 10 pages and have a different point of view and da 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 da. So I was freaking out that day, but you know, it was her like 15th day on the movie. It was a window into how sort of cool and chill she is that she totally rolled with it. And I was like, I'm sorry, nice to meet you. Can we run these? Cause I don't, she's like, yeah, of course. She was in the same boat as I was. We were like memorizing it, like between takes, we were still running it to try to get the words right. So, we were under a little bit of pressure, but she was so like calm and chill and understood like that's just part of being in a movie. It's going to change and you have to shift and adapt. And, I was like, oh, this chick could totally fucking pull some shit and be like, what the fuck is this? I have no time to work on this. We're pushing this until tomorrow. And she didn't. She's like, okay, this is what this day is going to be like. So Excellent. Let's just do it. And so she was great.
She didn't grab you by the lapels and you'll never work in this town again. And this
stuff. I wish. Because that would have been a better story. But no.
When was the first time the Red Sox broke your heart?
Well, I was alive in 78, but I my brain hadn't developed enough for me to understand what a baseball game was or what television was, really. But I guess for me, it was certainly 86. I remember game six. I remember it was a Saturday night. I remember there was a babysitter. My parents went out to dinner. They had something to go to. And I remember watching it. And it started late. It started at like 8 o'clock. And usually, like, I was a little kid, so I went to bed at, I don't know, probably 8:30 or 9 maybe on a Saturday. Who knows? But it was, I remember the guy parachuting in vividly. I remember the commercials. I remember the commercials for Alf. And I remember having faith in Calvin Schiraldi. I remember thinking, Calvin Schiraldi had a pretty good season that year, didn't he? Or am I crazy?
No, he did. I remember earlier in the season, I was a bit of a youngin' too when that happened, but that's the same time. I distinctly remember collapsing in a heap when that ball went through Buckner's legs, and that was the game changer for me.
Yeah, me too. I remember the next game was the following night, or no, maybe it was a Friday night, and the next game was rained out or something, and then Game seven was on a Sunday or a Monday?
It was on a Sunday or Monday because I remember, yeah, it was. Game six was definitely a Saturday.
Yeah. I think it was on Monday because I think it got rained out the next day. But I couldn't, my mother made me go to bed during game seven because I had school in the morning. She forced me to go to bed. Oh. Not a baseball fan, my mother. So I remember waking up not knowing what had happened. And my mother came into my bedroom to get me ready for school. And I said, did the Red Sox win? And she looked at me and she just shook her head. Like she didn't even have like the power to say, like she couldn't say no. She just like, she knew how much it was going to fucking break me. And she just like shook her head and like walked out of the room. And I was like, oh, fuck.
It's like asking if your dog mate it ever came back home.
Exactly.
Is Chuckles back? I'm
exactly.
sorry.
Is Grandpa still with us? Just a head shake.
Just a head shake. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Not even
I mean,
words.
So I think that was really the first. That was really the first time, and then you know, multiple times after that for sure. But there have been so many moments that have been so, like, I look back on them fondly now, but. You know, because of us winning championships. But Aaron Boone, I mean, that brought me to tears, and I was a full-grown man.
Oh,
I was in a shitty part of my life. I was like, I was on tour with this play that I was miserable in, and I was like, I just hated the. I was lucky to have the job, but I fucking hated it. And I was like the understudy, and I was just like, I was anxious and traveling all over the place, and I wasn't enjoying it. And the one thing that I looked forward to every day was like. Reading Bill Simmons' columns about and Dan Shaughnessy's columns about the Red Sox, and then watching the game at night. And when Boone hit that home run, I was in the theater. I was in Los Angeles actually. And when Boone hit the home run, I was watching a little teeny tiny black and white TV backstage. And I like walked out in the fucking parking lot and was like weeping. And another guy in the fucking cast was like, "What the fuck? It's just a baseball game." And I was like, "Dude, this is all I had." Now this is my ultimate distraction. Now I have to focus on the truth, which is I have another 6 months in this fucking shitty job, and I'm miserable, and I want to fucking go home. So Boone, like, that one really fucking hurt just because of where I was at that time in my life. So I think it's sort of – sometimes it mirrors, like, where you are, you know?
Yeah, that was the worst. My dad was sick at the time, but he was still alive. And I remember calling him because Ortiz hit a home run off David Wells later on in that game in Game 7. And
yes.
I figured, this is it. And I remember like a smacked ass jumping around this fucking – I was on traveling for work, and I remember being on the phone. They're going to do it. This is it. They got it. And then the way it unfolded, which is – it was like peeling back layers of skin or putting bamboo under the fingernails, just how it just unfolded into this fucking cacophony of one horrible – it just – you couldn't have scripted it any worse if you were Red Sox.
It's just, you really couldn't. It was so frustrating that Giambi was the difference. He had two home runs in that game, or he had one home run in that game, and he was fucking, you know, he was juicing. If they had caught him before and he wasn't playing that game, Red Sox would have won. And we would obviously gone on the World Series and done well, but hey. That shit's in the past, brother.
You're right. Well, that's the thing. The next year, so if you could not have scripted a better return story the next year. I mean, when their win in 2004, are you in a better place then? Are you like calling the family back home at that point?
It's a heartbreaking story. I was doing the same play. I'd taken a break and went back to do this job, but I was like playing the lead role in this play. So I was like, well, of course I got to do it. And we were on stage. I watched until like the seventh, and I had to go on stage.
Oh.
So I missed the final out.
You couldn't break character and just yell into the audience, anyone know what the fuck's going on with the Red Sox game?
And it wasn't even – we weren't even doing a performance. It was like a tech rehearsal, but it was my first time as like a lead in a play, and fucking Morgan Fairchild is playing opposite me in this play. And I was like, well, I got to be professional. I can't be like, I got to check the score of the baseball game. She'll think I'm unprofessional. And – sure enough, like, we're in the middle of this fucking scene, and I heard screaming from off stage. And this girl, who I was dating at the time, comes running on in the middle of the scene, just, like, interrupts the scene. And she goes, the Red Sox just won the World Series. And I looked back at her, and I said, I know. And I've never forgiven myself for not saying, excuse me, Morgan Fairchild, I'm going to need 5 minutes here. I didn't do that, and I should have done it. And I will never allow myself to miss something like that again.
This is the autobiography title right there. Morgan Fairchild fucked up 2004, the whole thing.
Exactly. It's Morgan's fault, the make of your story. When I take my own life, that's gonna be the headline.
All right, I'm gonna make a bold comparison here, and I know nothing of the life of the actor, much like I know nothing of the life of the professional athlete. I really know nothing more than the life of the fucking marketing tool that I am, the office drone. But I'm gonna make a bold comparison. I think of the 2011 Red Sox, the stacked lineup. They had Carl Crawford, Adrian Gonzalez, John Lester, Josh Beckett. A lot of holdovers from the 2007 World Series champs, but they ended up in third. They didn't make the playoffs. Now, just work with me on this for a second. You were one of the stars of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, a show with big stars. You had Matthew Perry, who was huge at the time. I think he was right off Friends. Amanda Peet, who was gorgeous. Brad Whitford, created by Aaron Sorkin, who did A Few Good Men, West Wing, Sports Night, a pedigree of excellence. But the show only lasted a season. It was phenomenal. It only lasted a season. Is there a parallel there? I mean, like, going into 2011, everyone thinks the Red Sox are going to hit it. When you're as part of something like Studio 60, are you thinking to yourself, oh, this is my next 50 years fucking all mapped out here?
You're exactly right. And I wonder who I am. Maybe I'm Papelbon. Maybe I'm Keith Folk or whoever the fuck was closing.
You get the beer. Get the beer box for your head, and you could do it, man.
Exactly, dancing in right field. That's an apt comparison. The lesson is this: there's no such thing as a sure thing.
Gotcha.
Because you have to play the games. You have to write and act this, and shoot and edit the show. So there is no such thing as a sure thing. And that was a wonderful, albeit difficult, first lesson to learn when I moved to Los Angeles. I moved with that show, and I could not have been – and I was a huge West Wing fan. I was an Aaron Sorkin, like, obsessive. So when I got the call to have the audition, I fucking freaked out. And I remember I was at a Christmas party – for my agency, and there was the casting director for Warner Brothers was at that Christmas party, And I was chatting with her. Her name is Meg Simon. She still casts for Warner Brothers and the CW, and she's a big deal in New York. And she's a very important woman to know if you want to work in television. And she liked me, and I was talking to her. She's like, I think I have some for you. There's something that you could be right for. Because I'd gone in for her a bunch of times but never gotten anything. And I said, oh, yeah? She's like, yeah, it's Aaron Sorkin's new series. And I was like, holy fucking shit. And she's like, I don't know, but you could be right for it. So we'll see. And I went in and auditioned and then tested with Aaron and had to bring three characters, sort of like an SNL audition, which is sort of unusual. But yeah, I moved out here thinking like, oh my God, I'm going to have a fucking Rolls Royce with Emmys all over it. And I'm going to everything's going to be made of gold. And I'm going to do this for 10 years and transition to film and important independent movies that no one sees. And it's going to be fucking like, it's all set up. I remember after I got the job, the next morning, I walked into my agent's office to pick up a script for another audition for something else. And they were having their morning meeting, which was like in this glass encased conference room. And all the agents were sitting in there. And I walked past and the head of the agency looked at me and said, waved me in, and they gave me a fucking standing ovation.
God damn.
All of the agents. It was like one of those moments where I was like, it's working. Like, I just cracked it. I cracked it. I'm one of the couple hundred people who are able to fucking crack this code.
I am Carl Crawford.
I am Carl fucking Crawford. I can steal a base, I can hit for power, and I can play decent defense. But then I got to Fenway, and I got scared and booed, and my hamstring was hurting me, and I just abandoned baseball. I was, and then we came out here, and the show, the first few episodes were okay, and I think it was the third or fourth episode, the teaser, the cold open of the episode was Matthew Perry not being able to write the joke. And in West Wing, the cold open was like, India is going to invade Pakistan and we have to do something about it. And like the titles come in and you're like, you're psyched. This episode, literally, he like looks wistfully like adjacent to the camera, is like, I can't write this joke. And it like smashed cut to the titles. And I was like, oh, we're fucked. We're fucked. Like that sound you hear is the sound of millions of Americans turning off the television because no one cares. There was no stakes. We were supposed to assume that the stakes of writing the joke are the same as the stakes within the Oval Office, and that's just not the case. So that was, I think, what doomed that show, was that it took itself too seriously. But that was a bumpy, crazy year.
But that's that's the thing, though, is like professional athletes and actors and things like that. There's only, when you think of all the actors looking to get something like that, who even looking for a taste of something like a regular series, then to get it, it seems similar like to someone trying to get into the major leagues. You know, there's only a few who are going to do it, so the very fact that you do it is a pretty cool fucking thing.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, the thousands of kids who are playing high school baseball right now who are trying to get Division I scholarships, who are like trying to get scouted. Like, you know, if you're 17 and you can throw in the 90s, you're going to get attention. If you're tall, and that's just fucking DNA, basically. If you're tall and strong and can hit a round ball with a round bat. But as it gets more and more competitive, it gets harder and harder. And as you get to like double A, if you can't hit an off-speed pitch the opposite way, you're fucked. Doesn't matter how good you are in the field or how well you do against the fastball. Like, it gets harder and gets harder and harder and harder. And like, it gets a little bit narrower, and the things that you have to do well, the window gets really, really thin.
Right.
Same thing in trying to pursue a creative life, whether it's a music or performance or writing or painting or whatever the fuck it is. It gets thinner and thinner and more acute, the skill set that you have to have. And if you don't, you just, you know, there's someone who will, who has the ability to do that. So you just get pushed aside and that other person jumps ahead of you. So yeah, cutthroat, but
not an easy gig. Was having a because obviously you have your, and the whole fucking family is like dipped in magic waters. Your brother Rob, obviously, on The Daily Show and movies. And Alex, your cousin, I think, used to do the WHDH Sports, and now she's doing, I think she does the Rays games now. She does the Tampa Bay Rays games out
she's
there.
Like the Heidi Watney of the Tampa Rays. She does in-game analysis and stuff.
So was this like, are there any other, is the entire family famous? Are there
Yeah, Tom Cordry, my cousin who lives in Seattle, he worked with Bill Gates when Microsoft was like in sort of its like developmental stages. And Tom Cordry invented Encarta. Do you remember Encarta?
I do not.
Was it a
cereal? I don't know.
It was the a computer encyclopedia.
Oh, that's right.
And so in like it was like an interactive encyclopedia with videos and images, and you can look up anything. And so he like developed Encarta, and that was like the big fucking deal, like in 1991.
Damn.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a great uncle, Charles Cordry, who is the host of Washington Week, who was like a big political analyst. I think it was on like Channel ABC or CBS. It was similar to what Chuck Todd does, like Meet the Press. It was like Meet the Press. It was called Washington Week. Yeah. And he was the host of that forever in Washington. My cousins are from Annapolis. My dad's side. So there are some special Cordrys. Like, I don't think many of us have gone to jail, so that's good.
That's good. No taste for prison food yet. So.
Not yet. Oh. Not yet, thoroughly.
All right, I got one last question for you, and it's this. You were in a movie which I really love called St. Vincent. It starred Bill Murray. And I just am curious, in any encounters with Bill Murray making that film, did he try to staple a Cubs jersey to you?
It was that was one of those days where have you heard the expression like don't meet your idols?
Yes.
It was one of those days. He was wonderful and sweet and kind, but it was like one of the last days of shooting, and it was a Sunday, and we were in a bank all day, and he was getting frustrated and tired because it was like towards the end of the shoot, and he was wanting to go home. And we had all of our scenes together, and he was nice, but he was like, you go into those kinds of those days of work with your idols, which if you're lucky enough for that to fucking happen, you go in with the fantasy of them becoming your pal.
Right.
And when that doesn't happen, it's heartbreaking. And the last scene that we shot, which is not in the movie, it was like in the basement of the bank, and we had to shoot in where the safe deposit boxes are. And there were like bars, like jail bars that separate the hallway from where the safe deposit boxes were. And we were on the other side of the bars. So the camera had to shoot through the bars to get our scene.
Yikes.
And if I was off by a half inch, the camera wouldn't pick up my eyes and we'd have to go again. So I really had to hit my mark. But you can't look down when you're walking up to that mark. You have to look at the person you're talking to and hit it and just sort of like anticipate where you're going to stop. And the first time, it was like 7 o'clock at night. We were working all day and people wanted to go home. And the first time I like overshot it and the director said, cut, sorry, dude. You just missed it. You're right there, but just back a half inch. I'm like, I'm so sorry. We went back, and we did it again, action, and I, like, pulled up a little bit too short. And he's like, cut. Sorry, man. I know this is such a pain in the ass, but you really have to hit that mark. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. This one's going to be great. And Bill Murray says, here, man, it's really easy. You see this mark on the ground? You just have to walk up there and put your – he was explaining it to me as if, like, I had never done a movie before. And I was so deeply embarrassed and like ashamed. I was like, this guy thinks I'm like just off the fucking turnip truck and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And I was just embarrassed. And I was like, fuck, this is who Bill Murray thinks. This is what Bill Murray thinks of me.
Oh.
And that was like heartbreaking to go. And they're like, all right, cut. And we got it. I got it the next time. We did the scene and in like two takes. We're like, okay, we're done. And I shook his hand and said, thank you, it was an honor. He's like, oh, thank you. And but I went home like feeling sad because I didn't impress my one of my comedy heroes.
Oh, he didn't give you the Carl Spackler with the pitchfork up to your neck. Like, listen, you got to hit your marks.
Oh, I wish. Oh. I wish. Yeah. But he. One of the things that he did do, which was very unique, I've never seen happen, is between setups when they have to so they shoot coverage of a scene. So there's a scene between two actors and the camera has to go on both sides of the actor. And sometimes it goes way far or way close, depending on what the cinematographer wants to do. So there are these break periods where they have to move all the equipment and relight. Sometimes it takes 15 minutes, sometimes it takes an hour. So that time is just downtime where you're just sort of waiting. And he would play music. He had this like portable speaker with him, like a Bluetooth speaker. And he has really like interesting musical taste. Like he likes like indie rock and like Jenny Lewis and the New Pornographers and all these like cool bands that I like. And I was like, whoa, this guy has fucking great musical taste. But between setups, he would bring his phone over and he would just like blast music like through the room. And usually it's quiet, but he was like, let's lighten it up here. Let's play some music. And I've never seen anyone do that. And he had amazing musical taste. So that is something I admire about him.
All right. So comes as, at least in that regard, comes as advertised, Bill Murray.
Yes, for sure. Very cool. Very cool.
Excellente. Well, Nate, thank you. We've learned so much about your the Red Sox, your Fenway trivia. We've also learned that your DirecTV should be working phenomenally from here on out. So
I hope so. There's a guy on my fucking roof right now, and if it's not finished by 5 o'clock tonight because the Celtics are playing, there's going to be hell to play. You know what I'm saying?
All right. Well, let's hope it's not Nick Asaski up there. We'll see how we're doing. But
or Quintana maybe. I don't know.
If it's El Guapo, you'll know about it soon enough. Go see Nate in the Circle. Download. You know what? Just watch The Heat. If you haven't watched it in a while, watch it again because the fucking scene in the dinner table is just the best. You see it to see how a Boston action should be done. Follow him at I'm Nate Caudry, IMNATECORDDRY on Twitter. And when the Sox win the World Series this year, we'll have him back. And we'll
can't
talk
wait.
Some more. Excellent day, Nate. Thank you so much. Appreciate you staying on through the technical difficulties, and I hope the TV's up and running in time for the game tonight.
Thanks, take
all right,
care.
Man, be good.